Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. Your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, August 5, 2006. Here's what's coming up for you. After our news, we'll bring you coverage of last weekend's peace rally in Brattleboro, Vermont, featuring speeches on the U.S. involvement in current violence in the Middle East and impeachment possibilities here in the U.S. Our second hour will bring you a report from the Union of Concerned Scientists on global warming in New Hampshire, plus a segment on the myth of green nuclear power to follow up on our interviews with anti-nuclear activists from last week. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. And now for news you need to know. We begin with this story by Joshua Frank, published on counterpunch.org. Kidnapped in Israel or captured in Lebanon? Israel's invasion pretext under fire. As Lebanon continues to be pounded by Israeli bombs and munitions, the justification for Israel's invasion is treading on very thin ice. It has become general knowledge that it was Hezbollah guerrillas that first kidnapped two IDF soldiers inside Israel on July 12th, prompting an immediate and violent response from Israel. But numerous reports from international and independent media, as well as the Associated Press, raise questions about Israel's official version of the events that sparked the conflict. The original story, as most media tell it, goes something like this. Hezbollah attacked an Israeli border patrol station, killing six and taking two soldiers hostage. The incident happened on the Lebanese-Israel border in Israeli territory. The alternate version, as explained by several news outlets, tells a bit of a different tale. These sources contend that Israel sent a commando force into southern Lebanon and was subsequently attacked by Hezbollah near the village of Aita al-Chab, well inside Lebanon's southern territory. It was at this point that an Israel tank was struck by Hezbollah fighters, which resulted in the capture of two Israeli soldiers and the death of six. As the AFP reported, quote, according to the Lebanese police force, the two Israeli soldiers were captured in Lebanese territory near the border with Israel, where an Israeli unit had penetrated, end quote. The Associated Press departed from the official version as well. Quote, the militant group Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers during clashes Wednesday across the border in southern Lebanon, prompting a swift reaction from Israel, which sent ground forces into its neighbor to look for them, end quote. And the Hindustan Times, on July 12th, conveyed a similar account. The Lebanese Shiite Hezbollah movement announced on Wednesday that its guerrillas have captured two Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon. MSNBC Online first reported that Hezbollah had captured Israeli soldiers inside Lebanon, only to change their story hours later after the Israeli government gave an official statement to the contrary. A report from the National Council of Arab Americans, based in Lebanon, also raised suspicion that Israel's official story did not hold water, and noted that Israel had yet to recover the tank that was demolished during the initial attack in question. Quote, the Israelis so far have not been able to enter Aita al-Chab to recover the tank that was exploded by Hezbollah and the bodies of the soldiers that were killed in the original operation. End quote. Before independent observers could organize an investigation of the incident, Israel had already mounted a grisly offensive against Lebanese infrastructure and civilians, bombing Beirut's international airport along with numerous highways and communication portals. From the AP on July 31st, Israel strikes Lebanon targets despite pause. The Israeli Air Force carried out strikes Monday in southern Lebanon despite an agreement to halt raids for 48 hours. The airstrikes near the village of Taib were meant to protect ground forces operating in the area and were not targeting anyone or anything specific, the army said. Hours before the fighting started up again, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice urged the U.N. Security Council to arrange for a ceasefire agreement by week's end that would include the formation of an international force to help Lebanese forces control southern Lebanon. But Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz made clear in a speech to Parliament that Israel would not agree to an immediate ceasefire and had plans to expand its operation in Lebanon. Israel had announced the suspension of airstrikes for 48 hours starting at 2 a.m. Monday. The Army said that the temporary cessation of aerial activity would allow the opening of corridors for Lebanese civilians who want to leave South Lebanon for the north and would maintain land, sea, and air corridors for humanitarian assistance. By early afternoon Monday, roads from villages were packed with thousands of refugees in pickup trucks and cars. With many of the main roads too shattered for use, cars took to the dirt side roads, still waving white flags at their windows or covering the vehicles' roofs with white sheets. Lebanese Red Cross teams, escorted by UN observers, went to the village of Srifa to dig up more than 50 bodies believed still buried under rubble since Israeli strikes wiped out an entire neighborhood on July 19th. The bodies have begun decomposing, the Red Cross said. The largest death toll from a single Israeli strike before Sunday was around a dozen, and the Khana attack, where at least 34 children and 12 women died, stunned Lebanese. Heightening the anger were memories of a 1996 Israeli artillery bombardment that hit a UN base in Khana, killing more than 100 Lebanese who had taken refuge there from fighting. That attack sparked an international outcry that forced a halt to an Israeli offensive. And this from Israeli peace activist Gila Sivirsky, writing from Jerusalem last week. Brief peace update. In Jerusalem alone, 100 people turned up for a vigil on Sunday in a surge of anger, protest, and mourning following the killing of children and adults in Khana, Lebanon. Vigils erupted all over Israel, punctuated by the fury of passerby as they read our signs. I brought candles, but they did not stay lit in the cool evening breeze of Jerusalem. Others brought their own signs. On Saturday, we held an extraordinary mass march of Women Against War in Tel Aviv. Women came from 17 sponsoring women's organizations, and we estimate about 3,000 participants, including men. It was a dramatic sight marching through the streets dressed in black as a sign of mourning for the victims on both sides. While the tabloids ignored us, Haaretz published a photo and detailed caption, and NRG, one of Israel's biggest news portals, told the whole story. The Arabic press gave us front-page coverage, and some of the foreign press also captured the story. This was an important action in a society in which the voices of women are always marginalized and entirely erased during times of war. It was an amazingly long procession, and we could see people hanging out of balconies to watch and sometimes curse. No surprise, with 90% of Israelis in support of this war. The anti-war movement in Israel seems to be inching forward, though the vast majority of Israelis continue to view us as traitors. The international anti-war movement is a great source of solidarity for us here. That was an update from Gila Sivirsky, an Israeli peace activist in Jerusalem. Our last story today is closer to home, published on July 25th by the Boston Globe. Overpasses become activist podiums. It takes only a bedsheet and 18-gauge wire for Bruce McDonald to stir road rage in some motorists. For 8 months, the Cambridge lawyer has been stringing homemade banners from highway overpasses. His neatly painted messages usually take short jabs at the Bush administration or the war in Iraq. Tens of thousands of cars can stream beneath an Impeach or U.S. out of Iraq banner before it is ripped down, usually by a passerby or road crew. McDonald, 59, is one of an increasing number of highway bloggers, loosely connected activists who favor bridges over websites as posting places for their anti-war slogans. They say it is an easy, inexpensive way to reach large numbers of people, especially those who may not be receptive to their opinions. While highways have long been used to publicize everything from political candidates to marriage intentions, after the disputed 2000 presidential election, a small group of self-proclaimed freeway bloggers began plastering California overpasses with signs criticizing President Bush. Since the Iraq War began, the campaign has gained popularity nationwide, especially on the East and West Coasts. Patrick Randall, a pseudonym for the California Man, cited by several local highway bloggers as their inspiration, said in an interview that he considers major thoroughfares rivers of humanity. In the past 6 years, Randall said, he has lugged about 2,500 cardboard anti-war signs to freeways and fastened them to fencing and beams with bungee cords. He has honed the on-site installation process to a frenzied 10 seconds. Because the reaction to Osama bin Forgotten and other foot-high slogans is often visceral, the 44-year-old Bay Area resident said he uses a fictitious name in public. Quote, I get a lot of hate mail and death threats from right-wingers, and I have a family. End quote. Randall promotes freeway blogging on his website, freewayblogger.com, and through a 2-minute instructional video, How to Reach 100,000 People for Under a Dollar. Affixing banners or signs to overpasses is prohibited in some states, including California and Rhode Island, but Massachusetts does not have a written policy. How long a sign remains is up to the discretion of highway crews, said John Carlisle, a Massachusetts Highway Department spokesman. In general, if any of our maintenance crews see political messages, we take them down, Carlisle said. Non-political ones, we judge them on a case-by-case basis. Those that hang from the outside of fences are immediately removed, he said, because they could fall onto passing vehicles. But bloggers say the state's tolerance of some people's handiwork, especially the ubiquitous greetings from military personnel returning from overseas, means it is obligated to allow anti-war messages as well. McDonald, who started highway blogging in response to what he described as the prominent public display of pro-war messages, said, The interesting thing is who makes a decision as to which messages are appropriate. There are some welcome home banners that have been up for months and are loose. Mass Highway doesn't think that's a priority. Earlier this month, he attached two anti-war banners to a bridge on Route 93 in Wilmington, alongside American flags someone else had already secured. 2 days later, only the flags remained. A Rhode Island blogger who asked for anonymity because he fears retribution from local and state officials said he began securing anti-war messages to bridges because there are so many blogs and endless websites, and I had a strong feeling that I wanted to do something in the real world. Highway blogging is a growing movement, reflecting people's frustration and their feeling that they're unable to speak out in any way, said the 44-year-old healthcare worker. And I love low-tech solutions to things. This is essentially the opposite of what we're expected to do culturally, which is pay for advertising space. That's all for our news today. Next, we go to Damon Thomas, reporting from last weekend's peace rally in Brattleboro, Vermont.
This is Damon Thomas from Making Waves. As I speak to you, I'm narrating from the Brattleboro Town Common. It's Sunday, it's July 30th, and there's a fairly sizable peace rally occurring here with hundreds of people gathered around a center stage where speakers and music are being featured. A number of tables are being exhibited with literature and posters, and a number of signs, numerous signs, calling for the impeachment of President Bush, signs declaring that war is terrorism, to stop corporate terrorism. The crowd is represented by all ages and types of people, and with one unifying cry, and that is a call for peace and an end to the warfare. Another, many signs saying, end the war in Iraq, others with the Q scratched out, and end the war in Iran, anticipating further warmongering on the part of the Bush administration. We'll be speaking to different folks over the course of the afternoon, and we'll also be getting some remarks from some of the featured speakers. And here are some remarks from some of the people who have been in attendance here as to why they're here. But first, we hear from Dennis Morrison, who stood in front of Lyndon Johnson's White House in his opposition to the Vietnam War. Let's hear what he has to say.
I'm Denny Morrison. I am the independent candidate for Congress in this race. I'm tired of the bigotry. I'm tired of the blood and the brutality. I'm tired of them totally. And I think an awful lot of Americans are. So you heard a little tiny bit of my history. I'm a retired business guy, was a Republican. Long ago was a Liberty Union guy. Still love them. Running for Congress. This is what I care about right here, among some other things. I will vote for impeachment if I am there. Absolutely I will. Unlike the present so-called independent. I did get court-martialed, but we beat the court-martial, as Dan said, thereby stealing the first half of my speech. So I'll have to improvise a little bit here. Full page, New York Times, George Bush, a week ago. Probably this quote has been vetted. Here's the quote. I trust God speaks through me. Without that, I couldn't do my job. I've got news for George. What we know from quotes like this is he is either the biggest, most manipulative slime ball we've ever had in office, or take your choice, he's a nutcase. Maybe both. I want to read one other little quote to you that I clipped from Ron Susskind article in the Sunday New York Times well over a year ago, maybe as much as 2 years ago. Here it is. These are the most chilling words I have ever heard in the real world in English. You can hear stuff or read it this chilling in George Orwell's 1984, but this was real world, and the guy who gave Susskind this comment has not been identified. I think I know who he is, but I can't prove it. Here is the quote. He was speaking to Susskind, who was interviewing him, and asking some questions, and he was getting frustrated with Susskind's questions. So he cut Susskind off, and he said this. We're an empire now. And when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. That's bone chilling, and that's exactly what you're seeing in Lebanon right now. They're trying to bait Iran in and bait Syria in. They want warfare from one end of the Middle East to the other. They want it. They're bringing it forward, and it has to not happen. It has to not happen. So there's those things. Here is a man in an administration full of strange people who bear the N-word, and they are not at all different from those N-word people we were familiar with in the early 40s in Germany. They're not different at all. And what this fellow does, their little pipsqueak, rich boy, spoiled boy, what he does is he grins a lot, and he lets Congress pass laws, which Congress is wont to do. They like to do it. They tell you the law is about this, and it's really about that. But they like to do it. They like to get their names in the paper. And they do pass a lot of laws. Something like 600 plus, approaching 700 times in how long has George been in office? 6 years, five and a half, 6 years? Something like 700 times George has done the following. Congress passes the law, which is their responsibility. George doesn't veto it and doesn't give him any guff. He just attaches, he smiles, he signs the law, and he attaches a little thing to it called a signing statement, which basically says, You can pass all the laws you want. I'll obey them or not obey them as I damn well please, because I'm the president. That's what those signing statements say, and he's done it 700 times. If that isn't the most egregious violation of our Constitution, our democracy, ourselves, our intelligence, our families, I've never seen anything like it, nor have you, nor has anyone. So I don't know what the hell this Congress is waiting for, and I don't know what Bernie Sanders' problem is. We need to impeach these men, and furthermore, we need to do something else. And it's almost too late now, this year, to do it. I have to tell you, I spent a year trying to get people all over the country to run for Congress. Couldn't do it as independents. They just won't do it. We're going to have to take the seats, folks. You and me and regular, decent, ordinary, intelligent, caring people are going to have to take the seats. You can demonstrate. You can come to the park. You can sign petitions. We all do. It's good stuff. It gets people's juices flowing. But we have to take the seats because the people in the seats are doing the voting and they're not voting for us. We have to take them, all of us, in the legislature, in the town council, and in the Congress of the United States. I would really, really, really like to have your vote. Thank you very much.
My name is Bill Cross. I'm a co-founder of the West Point Grads Against the War. And we were formed essentially to regain the honor of the United States because we were taught as cadets to that we should not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. And we find that this current war is based on lies. And our calling for an impeachment of Bush and Cheney for perpetrating a war that is essentially based on lies. We find it particularly difficult for people who are serving in the military at this time. And by the way, we have over 150 members now in our organization of grads from West Point, some of whom are on active duty. They're in Iraq, and they're being called upon to act in ways that essentially are going against this whole notion of not lying, cheating, or stealing. And we find that is not only impeachable, it borders on criminal, putting our people in that position. That's what we're trying to do. That's our aim. We're going to be expanding our organization to include the Annapolis and Air Force Academy, called the Service Academy Grads Against the War. And one of those members is going to be talking later, Dud Hendricks, who's an Annapolis grad. And we hope that this is just going to be expanding organization as we go along here.
Is there a way that people who active soldiers or maybe members of their families or other interested parties could contact you?
Yes. They can contact us at westpointgradsagainstthewar.org. We will respond to every email. We have it's called an honor guard, which is the group of people who are supporting us who are not grads, and including family members who are part of the military today. And there's a whole series on our website that shows messages from the world that has their testimony. So there's a place where they can go.
And I thank you for your time.
I'd like to especially thank members of my band for doing this for free. It's a friend. Thank you. Zimba. So, today we have about another hour's worth of some music and a lot of speakers, a lot of information. The point of this rally today is not to make people come out on a day and say, man, this is cool, good music, people speak and I feel good, now I'm going to go home. The point of this rally is to mobilize. The point of this rally is to enlist people to call for action. We really need to take things into our own hands here. People say to me, why are you having a demonstration in Brattleboro? Everybody knows, everybody in Brattleboro's on board already. Well, yeah, people in Brattleboro are on board, but that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything until we do something. When the towns in five Vermont towns voted for impeachment, it actually did something. It shocked people. It got people talking. Impeachment is now part of the national conversation, largely in part, unfairly I would say in part, but that's the way it is, largely in part because of a few Vermont towns that put it on the agenda. We're talking about it and people are talking about it. So it's time to take the next step, people. It's time to move this to a higher level of national consciousness. We have to raise the profile. We have to take the action which is going to move it to the next profile. We think that we have quality politicians in Vermont. We're wrong. We don't have quality politicians. We have politicians as usual in Vermont. Our so-called independent congressman, socialist, Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders can't get far enough away from impeachment. Bernie Sanders is not willing to even vote for a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Lebanon. Bernie Sanders just 2 weeks ago voted for the Iran Freedom Support Act, which gives George Bush a green light to start his next war of aggression against his next victim. That's our Bernie Sanders independent. We need to put serious pressure. And why does he do this? Because he knows, what are we going to do? Vote for Rich Tarrant? Probably not. So he takes every one of you for granted. You're in his pocket. So he doesn't care. He doesn't care that we think the war in Iraq is wrong. He doesn't care that we think valuing the Constitution is right. All he cares about are where his next big donations are coming from, which is from the centrist do-nothing wing of the Democratic Party. We need to send a strong message to Bernie that we are not just going to stand by and pretend that he represents our interests. We will take matters into our own hands. We can do more than one thing at a time. We can vote for somebody, and at the same time, we can work for impeachment. We can work to end the war in Iraq. People are going to talk about various objects. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about impeachment. Today, we are speaking with people from Maine, from Connecticut, from various states. We have two basic, really good mechanisms to get impeachment out into the public arena. One is, in New England states, we have town meeting. Any one of you, with about 3 hours' time, can get 10% of the voter checklist to sign a petition calling for a special town meeting to call for impeachment. We have at one of these tables, I'm going to read off all the tables. We have a table over here that has all that information. You can just pick up one of these petitions, fill in the name of your town, and go with it. 70 or 80 people sign on. You have a special town meeting in your town. You discuss impeachment. People come. They will vote for it. I guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee you, but I would promise you that in your town, any town in Windham County, for sure, and in most towns in the state, when people understand that, number one, impeachment isn't the trial. Impeachment isn't throwing them out of office. Impeachment is the equivalent of an indictment. Impeachment says, this man has, there's enough evidence here that crimes have been committed, that it needs an investigation, and if that investigation, you give one lawyer subpoena power, you'll have impeachment of the President of the United States. So obviously, we need to get Democrats elected in the fall because Republicans won't do it. But to think that we can get the Democrats elected and they will do anything at all without us, you're dreaming. It's entirely up to us to put the pressure on. So, I would like to now, Cindy Sheehan was the instigator. I asked her if she would come. She said she would. And I think without the fact that she was willing to come, I wouldn't have been able to get so many really great people interested in traveling so far to come here. So in a way, she is with us in spirit. She sent a statement to me this morning on email. A representative from Code Pink, Tish, is going to come up, read what Cindy had to say, and then I'd like to welcome Dud Hendrick from Veterans of Peace of Maine to come get ready to come forward also. So please welcome from Code Pink, New England Regional Coordinator, Tish Ingerman.
Hello, people. What a great day to be in Vermont, huh? It's beautiful here. And it's wonderful being together. And I know that Cindy, our good friend, would have just absolutely loved this event. As you may know, Cindy's not here because she's headed for Jordan with a delegation of Code Pink women to meet with the Iraqi parliament. There are members of the Iraqi parliament who have put together a 28-point peace plan that immediately calls for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Code Pink will be meeting with them, bringing that plan back here, and one of our main goals is to work with the Iraqi people. That's what we do. And that's why Cindy's not here today, because she's off doing that. But she did send a handwritten note that I would like to take a minute to read to you. It says, "Dear Vermont, I am so sorry that I couldn't make it for your event. I am sure that it will be awesome. I want to thank Dan DeWalt for all he does on this issue and to make the world a better place. And I would like to thank all of you for your commitment to peace and justice. The Iraq War is the most pressing and urgent issue of today. George Bush himself said that the problem will have to be solved by future presidents. Are we about to stand for that, people? I don't think so." That statement tells me two things. And first of all, he is once again leaving his messes for other people to clean up. And secondly, and most importantly, for the sake of the world, we need a new president. And I don't think we want to be waiting to 2008 for it. I would like to invite all of you to come to Camp Casey this summer to help us bring the end to this nightmare closer and to share space with people who believe the same as you. Keep up the good work, love, and peace soon. Cindy Sheehan. Let's give it up for Cindy. Definitely here in spirit.
So now I'd like to introduce a man who is a graduate of the Naval Academy in Annapolis and a co-founder of Service Academy Graduates Against the War from the coast of Maine, Mr. Dud Hendricks.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you. I first want to introduce to you a friend of mine and one of the leading activists from Maine, Maureen Block. If Maureen could wave to us all over here. Maureen, come on, let them see who you are. This is relevant. I want you to know who Maureen Block is. Her son Nathan is sitting in a prison in Oregon, having been accused of what is being called eco-terrorism. Now, this is very relevant to all of us today, all of us activists, because we are in the same jeopardy that Nathan Block is facing. He's looking at perhaps a 100-year sentence for a crime that he allegedly committed that involved no harm to anybody, no physical bodily harm to anyone. That sentence could be reduced if he is to cooperate with the feds to perhaps 3 to 15 years. So what kind of a judicial system is that we have that would use the tainted testimony of someone under that sort of pressure? This is what we're calling the Green Scare. And it is the same sort of tactic that's being applied to activists of all stripes. And I think it's also relevant and reveals a culture that values personal property more than human life. So Maureen, we wish you well in the struggle your family's enduring. As I thought about this opportunity to speak today, I kept returning to questions that haunt my internal dialogue all the time. And they are, what kind of people are we? And the corollary, what kind of country is this? Eleanor Roosevelt asked, when will our consciences become so tender that we act to prevent human misery rather than avenge it? I think that we are all here this afternoon because we are demonstrating that we do have a conscience. And we do empathize, and we will not be complicit. The generally somnolent American public is in a great state of denial, and I want to speak about denial and accountability. My activism is driven by an appreciation for Howard Zinn's perspective of American history. Yes. It's a history that we might guess is known by many more Americans than the silence might suggest, but the mainstream media denies us the opportunity to really know the ramifications of our foreign policy. History through the Zinn lens. It's a history that is no mystery to the world at large. The rest of the world is well aware that next week will be the 61st anniversary of America dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which led to the deaths of some 200,000 civilian men, women, and children. The obliteration of those people, the incineration of those people. It is also well known, as is the attendant hypocrisy, that today our arsenal has some 10,000 nuclear weapons in it. How about my war, the Vietnam War? The world knows of the lies manufactured to take us to that war that led to the deaths of 2, maybe 3 million Vietnamese and 58,000 young men and women, American men and women. Do Americans think about the over 20 million gallons of herbicides, to include Agent Orange, dropped on that countryside? Over 6 pounds per Vietnamese citizen. The gruesome legacy of that, in part, can be seen today by visiting the Tu Do Hospital in Saigon, where jars line the walls filled with the aborted and full-term fetuses of grossly deformed fetuses. I've been there. I've seen that. There are 10 to 15 million bomb craters dotting the countryside of Vietnam that are still visible from the skies above, and I have seen many of those. Ronald Reagan said, when asked, "What were you doing over there all those years? What was it about?" Well, Reagan said, "I'll tell you pure and simple, it was a noble cause." Doesn't that sound frighteningly familiar? Cindy Sheehan would tell us how familiar that is. Do Americans think about the continuing loss of limbs to American cluster bombs in Laos and in Cambodia and in Vietnam? The world does. Do Americans know about the 3,000 Dominican Republic citizens who were killed during our invasion of that country in 1965? Well, the world knows. Do Americans know that 15,000 Panamanians were left homeless and perhaps thousands were killed when we invaded that country to get Noriega? And do we know that King George I, when asked if that was worth it, said yes? The world knows, and the world also knows, that that was essentially Madeleine Albright's response when she was asked essentially the same question with regards to what we did in Iraq in 1991. On that occasion, during Desert Storm, Baghdad's water supply and their sewage treatment plants were destroyed, even though it was later divulged that the Defense Intelligence Agency had warned that it would do no harm to Saddam, but that it would lead to epidemic disease. A UNICEF study subsequently estimated that over 500,000 children under the age of 5 perished because of that action. Madeleine Albright said it was worth it, and the world knows. The world also knows of the 100,000 Iraqis who, in full retreat, were slaughtered in a single day by American jets and bombs on the so-called Highway of Death. Like shooting fish in a barrel, said one U.S. pilot. He could easily, just as easily have said, like shooting sand niggers in a sandbox. Now, you can't hang all of this on King George II, I know. So in the interest of time, let's jump ahead to the consequences of our recent work in the Middle East, ignoring the legacies of Nicaragua and Honduras and Guatemala and Sudan and Haiti and you name it. The world knows of Fallujah. The world knows of Abu Ghraib. The world knows of Guantanamo. The world knows of the checkpoints and the rapes and the murders and of the war profiteers. And I'll tell you this, the world knows about Bremer's laws, too. And the world knows it's not a case of taking democracy to Iraq, but that it's an economic hijacking of that country. They, the citizens of the world, know that in the wards and hospitals of Iraq, there are the victims of depleted uranium. Children without eyes, children without brains, children without genitalia, and other so-called congenital anomalies. So revoltingly grotesque. The American media turns a blind eye and a deaf ear, but the world knows. Now today we have another conflagration in the Middle East, and the hypocrisies are monumental. But will we know it based on the reporting of the talking heads? The world knows, and the world knows that Israel has American endorsement, is using American munitions, flying American aircraft, applying American tactics and strategy, and demonstrating the American model of state-sponsored terrorism. Ward Churchill points out that the peoples of the Middle East aren't like Americans, not least because they don't value human life in the same way. By this, it should be understood that Middle Easterners, unlike Americans, have no history of exterminating peoples purely for profit. Thus, we can appreciate the fact that they do value life, all lives, not just their own, unlike their American counterparts. The record that I've recited and the response to it here at home and in our Congress is testimony to our loss of humanity as a people and to our denial, if you will. The Code Pink Fast, which we now hope is nearly terminated as Code Pink fasters will be going to Jordan, and our gathering here today is symbolic of our effort to keep our heads above the rising tide of our heinous disregard for the other, so evident in the history of our country, but perhaps never displayed so arrogantly, so blatantly, so callously as by the Bush administration. With respect to accountability, I am not wearing this impeachment shirt today just as a matter of casual fashion. The word and the idea have to enter the mainstream. We all have to be willing to discuss it. It is an important strategy that we all should pursue. We need to talk about it in the streets, in our neighborhoods, and across the fence in the backyard. It should happen. They should be held accountable, and we have an accountability to speak to it. At the meeting this morning, there was great unanimity with respect to that purpose, and we hope that we, as activists, will be good to our promise that we'll go back to our communities across New England and New York State, and we will press upon our families and friends to in fact seek and work for impeachment. And we will work towards having resolutions passed in our towns and towards having it on the November ballot. And I hope you'll join us in that effort. I want to close with one last reference to conscience. And this is by Norman Solomon, the author of War Made Easy. And Norman Solomon said, conscience is not on the military's radar screen. It's not on our television screen. But a government officials and media messages do not define the limits and the possibilities of our conscience. We do. We do. We do. Thank you.
The theme of this rally has been war and impeachment, and other speakers will follow in that regard.
Western Mass.
But first, the Raging Grannies from Western Mass.
Sing a song for us.
No more lies from Dick and Georgie. We deplore their
With granny songs and voices strong, we'll fight with all our might until we end all wars. No more lives are Dick and Georgie. We deport at wartime. With granny songs and voices strong, we'll fight with all our might until we end all wars.
I forgot, believe it or not, those of you who know me, I was at a loss for words earlier. I forgot something. We also have an option in Vermont and in other states to put ballot initiatives on the ballot for November. So if you think it's too much to have a town meeting and you don't like having to voice your opinion in front of your neighbors or whatever, we can also, the same thing, 5% of the registered voters call for an initiative on a ballot, it goes on the ballot. So in your town in November, along with everything else, you can be voting on a ballot initiative to either get the troops out of Iraq or to impeach the president and the vice president. Ellen Tenney, who's walking around in a red shirt right over there, has petitions. She's got copies of those and you can get them. Our next guest spent 2003 in Iraq as a member of our armed forces, United States Marines. I'm really pleased that he's decided to come and join us today and speak about what he has to say. Mr. Joe Turkut, Iraq Veterans Against the War from New Hampshire.
Hey, how's it going? My name is Joe, and I'm from Iraq Veterans Against the War. It's a veterans organization made up of anybody in the military or out of the military who served in the military since 9/11. Anybody. You don't have to have been in Iraq, you could have been in the Navy. But we do have one thing in common, is that all of us believe that we were lied to about going into Iraq, and we're all pretty pissed off about it. Like he said, I was in Iraq in 2003 during the initial shock and awe campaign. I was in an artillery battalion. Now, I don't know how many of you out here know what artillery is, but basically I assisted in firing a large cannon that's about the length of two station wagons put back to front. And we could fire around about 40, 50 miles. The round weighs about 100 to 150, almost 200 pounds. 155 millimeter. The story is like this. We all got called back early in 2002, Christmas vacation. And we were told to get ready to go overseas. We were probably going over to Iraq. Some of us didn't have very much time to say goodbye to our families. Well, we all got back to base, and by the end of January, we're all on a ship out of Norfolk, Virginia, on our way over to Kuwait. We got to Kuwait the end of February and waited and did some special desert training ops because most of us have never seen the desert before. Until Bush decided to give his infamous 48-hour speech. At that speech, I was sitting next to a truck in the middle of the night in Kuwait with my gas mask next to me, wearing full chemical protective warfare gear, which I now know was probably a really dark joke that they played on us, because that stuff's really hot, because we had the green stuff. We didn't have the desert camouflage stuff. And we were told to write last letters home to our parents. And that was pretty scary stuff because we didn't know what we were going to do. And the next morning, we drove north. We drove through the holes that the engineers had put into the berms. Oh, excuse me. I forgot to mention that night we were firing all night. We were firing missiles into Iraq. I don't know what we were hitting. I just saw them flying through the sky like little arrows of light. When we crossed into Iraq, it was like walking from the street onto the grass. Kuwait was a barren wasteland. Iraq, our greeting into Iraq was a beautiful, like, it looked almost like a lawn. It was green and lush. I don't remember even seeing any desert in Iraq, to tell you the truth. It was beautiful. There's a reason they called it the cradle of civilization. We didn't actually start firing or encountering any sort of resistance until we got to An-Nasiriyah. Now, if you don't remember where that was, I wonder if any of you remember the name Jessica Lynch? We had a small part in to play in her rescue. After that Battle of An-Nasiriyya, we moved around Baghdad because another Marine unit was trying to beat the army up to Baghdad where there was no resistance. How funny is that? We went over to the Iran border and then back down. My total time over there was about 2 months. But in that 2 months, you learn a lot about the kind of culture that the military tries to give you. We found out that it's proper and good to cheer when your superiors tell you that you're dropping large 100-pound bombs that have 100-meter kill radius on civilian population. Yes, we did. We dropped them on civilians, and they told us they were civilians, and they knew they were civilians. And they told us anyway, and they thought it was funny. We were supposed to cheer about that. They told us that they used chemical warfare on the Iraqi soldiers who were just trying to survive. Now, by chemical warfare, I mean white phosphorus. It's not an acid, it's a base that when it hits your skin, it burns all the way through as long as it has contact with oxygen. Now, that's like burning alive until you get something covering it, like mud or something, to seal it from being oxidized. We use that on the military, the Iraq military. When I got back from Iraq, I wasn't even out yet. I still had another 10 months or so left in. I realized that most of what we did was messed up. I knew at that point from reading various books on the subject, John Ritter's books, that there never was any weapons of mass destruction. And even if there was, they were long expired. So the fact that he told us there was a threat, the fact that he made us wear all this chemical warfare equipment, all these suits and do those ridiculous gas mask drills in the middle of the night, was for nothing. The CIA knew that. Everybody knew that except for, apparently, the president, who was either he was convinced by somebody that there was some there, or he was just lying to everybody's faces. I mean, we all believe he was lying, right? We all know he was lying, right? He knew it. How could he not know it? So when I got out, I joined Iraq Veterans Against the War and New Hampshire Veterans for Peace, and I've been doing this for about 2 years now. We have a cable access show in Manchester. We attend rallies all the time and try to work on that. Next week, Iraq Veterans Against the War will be having their first national elections. We'll be electing our first full-time board, president, secretary, spokesperson, and we will be hitting the country hard with a public education campaign and recruiting members of the armed forces. What we stand for is this. We believe we were lied to, purposely deceptive, and that hurts because all of us volunteered to join. We weren't forced, we weren't blackmailed, nobody twisted their arms. We volunteered to join for a specific reason, and specifically because we believed that we would not be sent to war over a lie. Well, big surprise, we were. That's why we're pissed. Second of all, we are not getting the benefits that we were promised and we deserve. A quarter of the people coming back have serious psychological problems, and they're not getting the care. The Army won't even admit there's such a thing as PTSD. They call it temporary readjustment syndrome. I don't know about you, but you talk to a Vietnam vet, that is not temporary. That is a permanent condition that lasts you and haunts you for the rest of your life. Third of all, we believe the Department of Defense is lying to us, the American people as a whole, and there's a media blackout on depleted uranium munitions that are hurting us. I've talked to VA doctors, and they tell me that there's a huge increase in the need of respirators and asthma. I have asthma now. I didn't have asthma before. And there's soldiers and vets coming back. They don't consider that a disability. Of course not, right? Well, if you look at the first Gulf War, almost half of them are dead from cancer and cancer-related and radiation poisoning, disorders and diseases. What's going to happen now? There's more soldiers over there now, I believe, than there was in the first Gulf War. What's going to happen in 10 or 20 years when they're all dying from leukemia? I think we should start the public awareness campaign now and talk about that. The most important, I think, was we should try to hold our leaders accountable for their actions. And the best way to do that, I believe, and our organization believes, and I know all of you believe, is impeachment. And I know for a fact that Iraq Veterans Against the War fully supports impeachment of these misleaders. And hopefully we'll see that coming up on a ballot in your state anytime soon. Right? Right? We're working on that? All right. Viva la revolution.
That essentially concludes the rally here at Town Common in Brattleboro, Vermont, and the message is clear. Impeach George Bush and the war. And war in Iran, Iraq, and stop the expansion of the war elsewhere. For Making Waves, this is Damon Thomas for Portsmouth Community Radio.
Well, the cowboy came from out of the west with his snakeskin boots and his bulletproof vest, gang of goons and his big war chest. Fortunate son, he was doubly blessed. Corporate cronies and the chiefs of staff bowing to the image of the golden calf. Starting up wars in the name of God's son, gonna blow us all the way to kingdom come. Man of God, that ain't the teachings of a man of God. Man of God, man. And the fundamentalists, you never have to tell them how the money's spent. You never have to tell them where their freedom went. Homophobes in the high command, waiting for the rapture like it's Disneyland. Hide all the bodies from out of view. Channel all the treasure to the chosen few.
That was Eliza Gilkison with Man of God.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.